Central London was turned into a giant rubbish tip by frustrated fans lashing out.
The reaction from England fans was both entirely predictable and in keeping with long-standing English traditions of extreme violence and disorder upon defeat. I mean, to support England means to support this sort of behaviour. I think it's an essential part of the supporter culture of the national team. You know, you can't really get more English than spiteful violence to make up for one's own deficiencies. The authorities don't exist to protect minorities, but to punish us. And what I found more disturbing was the number of black and brown people supporting England, you know, out of ignorance, a misplaced sense of identity, self-hatred. This should be a wake-up call for them.
These actions have now led to a Football Association review of England's conduct and condemnation by the London Metropolitan Police. However, if fans can't be properly held in check, England could risk major fines or even be banned from competing in the future. Robert Carter, London.
Yet another attempt by a banned terrorist organization at rebranding itself as a legitimate opposition group in exile. The Mujahideen Khalq organization, known as the MKO, which held its annual gathering in Albania, featuring generously paid politicians and former government officials from the US and Europe, giving carefully worded speeches in person or online. Among them, former British Parliament Speaker John Bercow, the man who recently defected the Conservative Party for Labour after launching a withering attack on his erstwhile party member, Prime Minister Boris Johnson. We reached out to Mr. Bercow's media representative requesting for clarification regarding his involvement with the MEK. Received an automated response saying they would be in touch shortly. We are yet to hear from them.
I think our politicians need to be careful about how they behave, and that's politicians of all colours. And I think, unfortunately, they're really stretching the bounds of ethics and what it is to be a public servant, which is very unfortunate.
Former politicians speaking at the MEK's annual gatherings is not without precedent. Over the years, the terror cult has splashed out sizable sums of money to enlist the support of people in power on both sides of the Atlantic. Most notably, former U.S. National Security Advisor John Bolton paid upwards of $40,000 per speech in 2018.
Only three reasons can explain why the former Speaker of the British House of Commons might speak to the MKO. Either he literally doesn't know of the thousands and thousands of people this terrorist organization has killed, or he doesn't care about that, or the money was so tempting that it became more important than any moral objection to the MKO.
The MKO, who used to be based in a large military garrison in Iraq, fought against Iran alongside Iraqi dictator Saddam Hussein in the 1980s and provided material and intelligence support in a conflict that lasted 8 long years and left hundreds of thousands dead, injured, or displaced on either side. In 2000, they were designated as a terrorist organization. 12 years later, the U.S. government removed them from a list of terrorist organizations, and in 2013, the terrorist group relocated to a vast and tightly guarded barracks in Albania that few outsiders have ever entered.
Experts say to see former American and European officials support a known terrorist organization in return for money speaks to the double standard exercised by those individuals when it comes to the issue of terrorism. Saeed Puriza, London.
There seems to be no end at sight to tensions between the United States and China. In the latest development, China's military announced it drove away a U.S. warship that it said illegally entered Chinese waters near the disputed Paracel Islands. It also urged Washington to stop such provocative actions. In reaction, the U.S. Navy claimed that the USS Benfold asserted navigational rights and freedoms in the vicinity of the Paracel Islands. It also dismissed China's claim of a serious violation of its sovereignty as false and a misrepresentation. The U.S. move coincided with the fifth anniversary of an international arbitral ruling that favored the Philippines and invalidated China's maritime claims in the South China Sea. Beijing has consistently dismissed the tribunal's finding. Regarding the occasion, U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken called on Beijing to stop what he called aggressive acts in the South China Sea. Blinken said that freedom of the seas was an enduring interest of all nations.
Nowhere is the rules-based maritime order under greater threat than in the South China Sea. The People's Republic of China continues to coerce and intimidate Southeast Asian coastal states, threatening freedom of navigation in this critical global thruway.
The South China Sea has become a major bone of contention between Beijing and Washington over the past years. The U.S. routinely sends warships and warplanes to the region to assert what it calls its right to freedom of navigation, ratcheting up tensions among the countries in the region. China has constantly warned the U.S. over its military activities in the contested waters. Beijing and Washington are also at odds over a range of issues, including China's policies with regard to Hong Kong and Taiwan, as well as their trade policies and origins of the COVID-19 pandemic. Amid strained relations between the two sides, there have been fears that the South China Sea could emerge as a potential flashpoint. China had hoped for an improvement in relations under U.S. President Joe Biden, who succeeded Donald Trump in January. But a new administration has shown no sign of backing down on Trump's hardline policies toward China.
Kabul Bagram Highway, and we are on our way to Bagram District in northern Parwan province to visit Bagram Airfield. The 70 hectares airfield was known as the symbol of the U.S. military power in Afghanistan before its withdrawal from this key site. Now, Bagram Military Air Base, which was known as an American town in Afghanistan, is handed over to Afghan National Army, and the government says having control over Bagram helps Afghan forces to effectively manage and launch counter-terrorism operations against terrorist groups, mainly the Taliban. But as this army general says, the government needs more time to either collect all remaining tools, vehicles and other facilities or deploy military forces in Bagram.
Working group are continuing their work inside the Bagram. We don't want to lose the facilities which left by the American forces here. We are assured that we try to use all the facilities in the future. Some of the maybe Air Force branch will deploy here, but the priority right now to secure the area.
We got permission to see some insider parts of the airfield. The first destination is parking lot, where the U.S. forces left their military vehicles. Then we visited the Bagram Hospital. Officials say they are working to make it operational very soon.
The Health Affairs Department of the Ministry of Defense has planned to make this hospital in Bagram operational. That is why we are here working on the plan despite some problems like shortage of power and some administrative issues.
One of the other places to visit is the residential area, but when we were heading to this site, we faced many hideouts being used to protect U.S. forces from possible Taliban rocket attacks. However, it seems U.S. forces have even left their boots behind due to a hurry to leave this largest military base in Afghanistan. Bagram Military Airfield was considered as one of the strategic bases across Afghanistan not only during the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, but even earlier during the Soviet Union occupation of the country. Now, the Afghan government should decide how to protect this vast base and deploy Afghan forces here, Sayed Amin Alami, Bagram Air Base in northern Parwan province.
After 2 months of digging into a depth of more than 20 meters, Yemen's Mine Action Center managed to defuse one of the largest U.S. bombs dropped in Yemen's capital, Sana'a. The bomb was expected to target the civil defense building in Sana'a.
This GBU-24 bomb from the Paveway series was dropped in 2015 to target the civilian defense building in Sana'a next to Al Farah Park and Al Hasaba local market. The Saudi-led coalition has been using various types of advanced American weapons in its war on Yemen. This is a clear violation of the international humanitarian law.
Observers say this bomb is another proof of the U.S. military support for the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen.
We defused a GBU-24 bomb with a weigh of 1.5 tons. The bomb targeted this hangar designated for the maintenance of Yemeni civil defensive fire trucks. The explosion of the bomb could have caused a humanitarian catastrophe with great consequences. The U.S. has provided only a few countries, including Saudi Arabia, with such a bomb.
Over the past years, Saudi Arabia has used internationally prohibited weapons, including the U.S. bombs, to target residential areas across the country. Back in April 2015, Riyadh committed one unforgettable crime by bombing the Attan area with a U.S. cluster bomb, killing more than 100 civilians, including women and children. This American bomb dropped by U.S. aircraft is yet another witness to Washington's role in the war crimes in Yemen, as the U.N. turns a blind eye to such violations. Besides the military support, Yemenis say Washington has always been backing Saudi Arabia politically as a major ally in the region. Abdulatif Al-Washali, Sana'a.
Security situation is deteriorating day by day in Afghanistan due to the rising Taliban attacks, mainly on key cities and districts across the country. In an assault launched on Saturday, most of the suburbs of Ghazni city in southern Afghanistan came under Taliban control.
The attack pushed back Afghan forces into the city as they struggled to avoid the collapse of the strategic area, which is located very close to Kabul-Herat highway.
Officials in Ghazni say Afghan security forces are strongly resisting in the city, noting that dozens of Taliban militants, including foreign nationals, have been killed as a result of counter-attack operations by Afghan security forces.
The enemy has captured some areas in the suburbs of the city. This is because we tactically retreated from those areas. They also made efforts to enter the city, but we pounded them hard and pushed back the terrorists from the city.
This comes as thousands of locals have also stood alongside the Afghan National Security and Defense Forces to resist against the Taliban, a move which has been supported by influential figures and locals in Afghanistan.
Our great nation has always proved to be alongside the country's national security and defense forces. Our people will once again resist against the Taliban now that the militant group wants to expand its military grip.
Apart from consequences like rising violence and bloodshed in Afghanistan, tens of thousands of local Afghans have so far been displaced inside the country. In such circumstances, many have urged both the Afghan government and the Taliban to rather focus on political solutions to resolve their difference than engaging in a deadly conflict. Sayed Amin Alami, Kabul.
This is IRIB English Radio.
Get up. Good morning.
Good morning. Your captain is speaking, and we are currently cruising over Iranian skies.
گاه شهید بهشتی مسافرین گرامی خواهشمند از جهت تعیین مسیر به تابلوهای راهنما توجه فرمایید.
is everything. Good morning, all.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Good morning.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
The Supplication on Fridays. In the name of Allah, the All-Merciful, the All-Compassionate. Praise belongs to Allah, the first before the bringing forth and the giving of life, and the last after the annihilation of all things. The All-Knowing who forgets not him who remembers him, and decreases not him who thanks him, and disappoints not him who supplicates him, and cuts not off the hope of him who hopes in him. O Allah, I call thee to witness, and thou art sufficient witness, and I call to witness all thy angels, and the inhabitants of thy heavens, and the bearers of thy throne, and thy prophets, and thy messengers, whom thou hast sent out, and the various kinds of creatures thou hast brought forth, that I bear witness that thou art Allah. There is no God but thou, thou alone, who hast no associate nor any equal, and thy word has no failing nor any change, and that Muhammad, Allah bless him and his household, is thy servant and thy messenger. He delivered to the servants that with which thou charged him, and he struggled for Allah as is his due. And he gave the good news of the truth of reward, and he warned of the veracity of punishment. O Allah, make me firm in thy religion as long as thou keepst me alive, and make not my heart to swerve after thou hast guided me, and give me mercy from thee. Surely thou art the giver. Bless Muhammad and the household of Muhammad, and make me one of his followers and his partisans, and muster me in his band, and give me the success of accomplishing the obligatory observance of Friday, and performing the acts of obedience which thou hast made incumbent upon me within it, and receiving the bestowal which thou hast apportioned for its people on the day of recompense. Thou, only thou, art the mighty ones.
The Spotlight.
It is the anniversary of the Iran nuclear deal, otherwise known as the JCPOA, but it is not a time to celebrate. After weeks of talks in Vienna, the U.S. is still refusing to remove all sanctions, as Iran has demanded. This not only jeopardizes the outcome of the talks, but leads Iran to conclude that the U.S., headed by President Joe Biden, still believes the maximum pressure campaign actually works.
It was July 14, 2015, that Iran and the five permanent members of the UN Security Council, the US, France, Britain, Russia, and China, plus Germany, signed a nuclear deal known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, or JCPOA. The agreement was later endorsed by the United Nations Security Council with Resolution 2231. Based on the accord signed during the administration of then-US President Barack Obama, Iran undertook to put limits on its nuclear program in exchange for the removal of nuclear-related sanctions imposed on the country. Following the enforcement of the pact in January 2016, the International Atomic Energy Agency confirmed for 15 times in its reports, in a span over 3 years, that Tehran fully implemented its commitments under the deal. But in May 2018, Obama's successor, Donald Trump, unilaterally pulled the U.S. out of the deal and reimposed sanctions as part of his administration's maximum pressure campaign against the Islamic Republic, which spotlighted Tehran's mistrust of Washington. 1 year after Washington's pullout of the JCPOA, Iran began to roll back its commitments as the remaining signatories failed to secure its interests under the deal. Nonetheless, the administration of Joe Biden expressed readiness to re-enter the JCPOA, which paved the way for Iran and the remaining signatories to hold several rounds of talks in the Austrian capital to revive the deal. Iran has stressed that the deal cannot be revived unless the U.S. removes all sanctions in a verifiable manner. It has also insisted on a guarantee by the U.S. to not renege on the accord again in the future. Despite the Biden administration's willingness to restore the JCPOA, it has taken no concrete measures to that direction so far. Now, on the sixth signing anniversary of the landmark agreement, Iranian officials say the ball is in the U.S. court on whether it wants to continue its pressure campaign launched by the former administration or reverse its course. This also, as Secretary of State Antony Blinken has already described the Trump-era anti-Iran campaign as a failed policy.
Thank you for joining us for this edition of The Debate. Senior Research Fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Samioli, joins us from Budapest. Also joining us, political analyst and professor at the University of Tehran, Sayyid Mohammad Mirandi, who joins us. I'd like to welcome you both. Let me start with you, Professor Mirandi, if I may. We're looking at the JCPOA anniversary, which should be a joyous occasion, but the U.S. pulled out of the deal. It has incurred billions of dollars of damage to Iran's economy. So this, in a sense, should be a day where the U.S. should be held responsible to pay for these damages. What are your views when you take a look at this anniversary in terms of what it marks and what it signifies?
I think it not only exposes the real nature of the U.S. government, but it also exposes the nature of Western governments, the Western media, the Western political establishment, and that is that none of them can be trusted. The United States, as we speak, continues to impose maximum pressure sanctions. They have no intention so far to implement the nuclear deal, and the Europeans are siding with the Americans, and the Western media behaves as if the United States is not to blame. The United States under Obama, when they signed the deal, they failed even back then to abide by their commitments, and then under Trump they left the deal completely. The maximum pressure campaign, of course, was barbaric under Trump, but we have to also keep in mind that the whole notion of this maximum pressure campaign was Obama's. It was Biden and Obama that began targeting women and children to gain concessions from Iran. And ultimately, when they saw that Iran wouldn't bend the knee, Obama sent a message to Iran basically implying that he'll accept Iran's right to enrich uranium, and then the negotiations began. And then after, of course, President Rouhani won the election, we had a new type of negotiations, the P5+1 and Iran, and we had the deal. But the point is that U.S. behavior has been inhumane from the beginning. The United States never abided by its own commitments, whether under Democrats or Republicans. The Iranians did abide by their commitments, yet the Western media continues to depict Iran as the problem. Not only should Western countries be abiding by their commitments right now, but they should be compensating for the deaths and the destruction that has been carried out as a result of their violations over the last few years. Yet what we're seeing instead is Western governments continuing with the maximum pressure campaign so that they can get additional concessions from Iran. They have no intention of implementing the deal in full as we speak. I should stress, and that's something that would, in an insane world, be extraordinary. But for us, it's nothing unexpected.
First time, really, something that many don't recall, or that it wasn't highlighted, even though it was very evident, and it became very evident, was back in the time when the deal was signed. Lots of optimism, obviously, because of the signature, showing that diplomacy works. But then when it actually came to the execution part, in order for Iran to reap the benefits, it was becoming increasingly clear that that wasn't happening. People were afraid, countries were afraid to invest in Iran because they said at some point or another, the U.S. sanctions would bite. And many of these large companies and conglomerates, well, they had centers or franchises in the U.S. So when the money was to make its way around, they were afraid that somewhere along the line, the U.S. Treasury, for example, would jump on that. So this deal really did not even evolve or to come into fruition for Iran, did it?
That's absolutely right. It was already stated within the JCPOA itself the likelihood of the United States withdrawing. I mean, in other words, it was already envisaged that the United States would one day withdraw, and that's why other members of the JCPOA made their commitments that if the United States withdraws and reimposes sanctions, they will alleviate the pain that Iran would suffer as a result of their reimposed sanctions. That, of course, never happened. But it's clear that right there, even as they were negotiating, it was always on the cards that the United States would withdraw. And the United States never ratified the JCPOA, and so therefore, it was inevitable that the next man in after Obama would simply walk away, given the extent of the hostility toward Iran that is shared all across the political spectrum in the United States. I mean, if you look at Donald Trump, Donald Trump is a very controversial political figure, to say the least, in the United States. Many of his statements and his policies arouse a lot of rancor in the United States. The one policy that doesn't arouse rancor is his policy toward Iran. Yeah, that's passed, you know, without any problems. His assassination, illegal assassination of General Soleimani, that went by the board. You know, no one objected too much to that. So again, you know, now that we're having these negotiations in Vienna, we've already had six rounds. You know, you look around and say, the Biden administration has no particular political need to do anything for Iran. It has very limited political capital at home. It will only incur unpopularity, obviously, among the Republicans, but it will also incur a considerable amount of unpopularity even among Democrats. So that's why it's essentially been stalling, kicking the can down the road. We've had these six rounds of talks, now we're going to have a seventh round of talks, but it had made no real decision, no real commitment to return to the JCPOA.
Well, not to drag out the past, but Professor Morandi, I need to touch on this because it's rather important the way that the EU through the E3 played its role, which was very striking the way that the EU had to come out and say we can't force companies to do business with Iran or not. But they actually came out with a handbook, I think, explaining to these companies that, you know, it's okay to do business. And then they came out with this Instex, but nothing panned out. How do you assess the European role during that time?
I think we first have to go back to the Obama years and after the signing of the nuclear deal. almost a year after the deal was signed, the head of the Iranian Central Bank said in Washington, if I'm not mistaken, that nothing has changed. In other words, Obama never intended to implement the deal, let alone the EU three countries. They had no intention of doing anything for Iran. They were basically trying to buy time to keep Iran implementing the deal. They knew from the start they weren't going to do anything. After Obama signed the deal, a series of senior banking officials from Europe came to Iran, and they wanted to see me. So they came to my office, and they told me very explicitly that we are very interested in working in Iran. Important banks, if I name them, they're relatively well known. They said, we want to work in Iran, but the Americans have told us through back channels that if you go to Iran, we will punish you. This was after the deal was signed. This was under the Obama regime. This was not during Trump. When Trump left the deal and imposed maximum pressure, the Europeans never intended to do anything about it. All they wanted to do was to keep Iran in the deal, so that on the one hand, the Europeans would be imposing Trump sanctions against Iran, and Iran would be keeping its own hands tied. And Iran actually did that for a year, not because the Europeans wanted it, but the Iranians calculated that if they continue to implement the deal for a year or an extended period of time, it would make the United States look very bad. Whereas if the Iranians had left the deal right after the United States, we all know how the Western media works. Iran would be blamed. The Western media would ignore Trump and attack Iran, even though it was obvious that Trump was the problem. So the Iranians waited a year, continued to implement the deal, and then only after a year, in five steps, as you know, every 2 months, Iran began to decrease its commitments. And then after 2 years, almost 2 years, Iran was carrying out minimal commitments, let's say 30-40% of its commitments. It's, you know, debatable. It's subjective how to put a percentage on it. And then only a few months ago, as you recall, as we all recall, that the Iranian parliament passed a law where the Iranians discontinued its implementation of the deal. So the Europeans never intended to abide by the deal. The Americans never intended to abide by the deal. And right now, the Europeans and the Americans do not intend to abide by the deal.
Well, that obviously raises the question, to follow up on what just Professor Morandi said there, George Samieli, then why are the parties hashing out whatever it is that they're hashing out?
Well, I think they want to somehow lock Iran into the deal without their actually making any commitments themselves. And Biden did make a variety of promises during the election. I never took these promises seriously. They always seemed to be hedged and evasive, and people were eager. There were, you know, Washington pundits were absolutely insistent that, oh, Biden will return to the JCPOA. He's absolutely determined to do it. It was always nonsensical, and that he was always extraordinarily evasive. But the point is that by keeping the negotiations going, and then nothing would come out of it, it's a way of making sure that Iran will take the blame for any, basically, you know, failure to come to an agreement. Well, we bent backwards. We stretched out our hand. You know, we did what we could. We went the extra mile, but the Iranians were just so absolutely unreasonable. What can you expect? So I think a lot of it is just a lot of play acting in order to provide for the Americans a kind of a face-saving formula.
Well, I do have to bring in what Zarif has said on his Twitter account, and I'd like to get your reaction on this, Professor Morandi, out of respect, if anything. And him saying 6 years ago today, JCPOA received the UNSC Chapter 6 issue without resorting to war. Obama realized his crippling sanctions would not cripple Iran or its centrifuges. Trump ineptly thought maximum pressure would. It never will. I'm sure you've read this tweet by Zarif. What do you think?
It's complicated. I was never for or against the nuclear deal. I thought we could have negotiated better. The reason why we didn't negotiate better is very complicated, and I don't want to go into that right now. But I was always skeptical, and I was in Vienna at the time, and I told Dr. Zetti that I don't think the Americans will implement the deal. And as we speak, I don't believe we should leave the deal. I think Iran should remain within the deal, but I think Iran's current policy is an appropriate one. The Iranians are pursuing their nuclear program. They're expanding the nuclear program. That's how they gain leverage. And I don't think it should be the Iranians to exit the deal. If anyone's going to exit it, we should let the other side do it. But in order to make sure that the Europeans and the Americans recognize that Iran is not going to wait forever, I think there should be a policy change. And this is where I think the previous administration or the outgoing administration made a mistake. I think the new administration should tilt away from Europe and the United States. We should explore better relations with China, with Russia, with Asia, with the Global South, with regional countries and neighboring countries. They should be our priority. If the Europeans and the Americans want to come back to the table, if they want to come to their senses and implement the deal, fine. I'm not saying that we should break off ties with the Europeans in any way or form, but I'm saying that we should give them a clear message that we're not going to wait anymore and that we're going to engage with those countries that keep their doors open. And if they want to open their doors later on, that's fine, but we can no longer wait. And at the same time, I think that the Iranians are doing the right thing. I think the Iranian parliament passed a more or less good law where the Iranians will fulfill all of their obligations, or let's say they will expand their nuclear program and implement their right to have an extensive peaceful nuclear program within the framework of the NPT and the IAEA. And the regulations in NPT and the IAEA allow Iran to do many things. And I think Iran should explore all of them to the fullest to make the Americans and the Europeans feel the pressure.
Okay. Well, George Samueli, I want to get back to you on and test you on some of the things you just said there. But after I asked George Samueli this, George Samueli, we've had some exposure towards the incoming new administration headed by Seyed Ebrahim Raisi. And he has said, you know what, okay, we can continue the talks. But he said that this is not going to make or break Iran. If the U.S. Eventually pulls through, great. If not, Iran's going to move on. Do you get that impression?
I do get that impression. And I concur with Professor Miranda's assessment. I mean, it's understandable that Iran wants the U.S. sanctions lifted, but I think it's a hopeless endeavor dealing with the United States. What is important is that the United Nations Security Council sanctions have gone and they're not coming back. And therefore, Iran has a lot more room to maneuver than it did have a decade ago, because as long as it is building a peaceful nuclear energy program within the parameters of the Non-Proliferation Treaty, and as long as it's cooperating with the International Atomic Energy Authority, then it's going to have good trading relations with Russia, it's going to have good trading and relations with China, and therefore the whole dollar-denominated trading system, which was so painful to Iran, is going to become much less important. Russia is moving away from the dollar. The Chinese are moving away from the dollar. So Iran will be able to conduct oil trade, without reliance on the dollar.
Okay. So my final question goes to you, Professor Morandi. I don't know if you remember, Joe Biden was almost boarding a plane, and that was when the news came out that Iran signed that deal with China, that big deal. And when the reporter asked him about that, he was very angry. When he responded, yeah, this was in the works and I knew it would happen. Do you think that the U.S. does not, or one of the incentives it has, is it does not want Iran to gravitate towards China in the form and manner that that deal showed that it was going to, along with Russia, I'm assuming, and for this to be an incentive for the U.S. to actually want to have a deal with Iran?
The United States can't have its cake and eat it too. On the one hand, they want to impose maximum pressure on Iran, and they want Iran to sit quiet. They also impose sanctions and economic warfare on China, and they want China not to tilt towards Iran. And they impose sanctions on Russia, and they want Russia just to stand still. That's not going to happen, especially because the world is changing very rapidly. Western countries are on the decline. There's no doubt about that. I'm not saying that Western countries have no influence, but relatively speaking, they are on the decline. And by putting pressure on Iran, Russia, and China, they are creating a greater incentive for them to work towards each other. And I think it's the smart thing to do. These countries have a vested interest in making sure that the United States fails in its economic warfare. Because if the United States succeeds against Russia, that's a success against everyone. If the United States fails against Iran, that's a failure in its economic warfare against all countries. So it's smart for Iran to have good ties with all countries that want to have good ties with Iran. And if the United States and the Europeans come to their senses, so much the better. But if they don't want to come to their senses, then Iran, while maintaining its independence — Iran is fiercely independent — it will engage in the best of relations with those countries that want to have excellent relations with Iran.
Thank you very much. We're going to end it there. That's Sayyid Mohammad Morandi, professor at the University of Tehran. Thank you for your contribution.
Thank you.
And also senior research fellow at the Global Policy Institute, George Damiali, from Budapest. And that does it for this edition of The Spotlight. Thanks for tuning in. From Mikhail Vitahve, the entire team in the capital, Tehran. It's goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Our website is www.parstoday.com/en.
Tourism. In the name of God, Salam, and welcome to the second episode of our series, Health Tourism. In the last episode, we discussed various types of tourism and learned that medical tourism is one form of tourism which is growing significantly year after year. Many people travel to other countries with the aim of receiving quality medical services at a cheaper and more reasonable cost than they would at home. Please stay with us for a more detailed discussion of medical tourism. Health tourism is the result of combining two profitable industries, that is, travel and medical industries. Therefore, this kind of tourism also includes a variety of subcategories, such as medical tourism, curative tourism, and wellness tourism. All of them are named based on patients' needs. Considering a variety of definitions with regard to health tourism, we tend to mention all as health tourism, and our focus will be mainly on familiarizing patients with medical centers and services provided in the Islamic Republic of Iran. In order to increase their revenues, many countries all around the world are keen to offer medical services. However, due to the critical nature of this field and the lack of required medical infrastructure and experienced professionals, not all countries are able to do so. Among all countries, Iran is considered one of the best in offering medical services to foreign nationals. Benefiting from various eye-catching historical sites and stunning nature, the country attracts a huge number of tourists who come to enjoy Iran's tourist attractions every year. According to reports, Iran ranks 10th globally on the list of world's historical sites and 5th in terms of natural attractions. Besides that, Iran has become one of the pioneering countries in the region and the world thanks to its scientific development in the field of medicine, excellent and highly trained doctors, as well as utilizing state-of-the-art facilities, which has made this country a popular destination for medical tourists, especially those tourists and patients who visit Iran from neighboring countries. Nowadays, many patients from regional countries such as Kuwait, Qatar, Iraq, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Republic of Azerbaijan, Turkmenistan, and so on, prefer to travel to Iran instead of European countries to get medical services. The close distance between Iran and neighboring countries enables patients to go back in a short time after receiving excellent treatments from Iranian professionals and doctors and their brilliant expertise. Another reason is the reasonable cost of treatment in Iran that has made this country a popular destination for patients. The special attention from Iran's neighboring countries, as well as Iranian doctors' expertise and qualifications, has encouraged Iran's health ministry to launch a special department called Department of Health Tourism of Ministry of Health to facilitate health tourism for those in need and adopt rules and regulations for hospitals admitting foreign patients. According to these regulations, hospitals, clinics, and other medical centers with foreign applicants are required to launch International Patient Department, or IPD. Otherwise, they're not allowed to admit foreign patients unless in emergency situation. Medical centers with IPD permit are required to follow related instructions. Those hospitals with IPD permit should undertake few tasks, such as doing needed coordination for admitting patients, accompanying them during their stay in Iran, offering medical services and recovery cures after their surgery, and all sort of services patients need throughout their stay in the country. The IPD staff are responsible for responding patients' application and contacting them via phone and email and holding conference with their attending physician. Patients can easily contact IPD of each hospital to know more about the costs and services of treatment they offer beforehand. Also, the IPD staff are in charge of doing essential coordination with doctors and hospitals, coordination with surgery rooms, care unit, discharge and finance units. Currently, there are more than 150 hospitals and medical centers in Tehran and other Iranian cities with a special permit for treating foreign patients. Iran is one of the countries in the world with high expertise in treating cardiovascular diseases, infertility, ophthalmic and neurological disorders, as well as treating different cancers. Iran also benefits from a high reputation in the region in the field of plastic surgery. Also, the country ranks first in Asia and third in the world in kidney transplant with laparoscopy, and according to a 2019 report, ranks first in the world in liver transplant. Iranian optometrists are among high-ranking experts in the world, and the facilities being utilized in some optometry centers in Iran are the best ones that are being used in only few countries in the world. Most of the foreign patients in Iranian hospitals have been respectively admitted for female diseases, cardiovascular diseases, nose job, eye surgery, and general surgeries. The Iranian cities of Tehran, Qom, Mashhad, Ahvaz, Urumiye, and Shiraz have received most of the foreign patients. Patients and medical tourists can receive more information about hospitals and medical centers with IPD permit in various ways. One of them is the Iran Ministry of Health Medical Tourism Department. Its website is iht.en.behdasht.gov.ir. By a quick browse in this website, you can get information you need about the hospital and medical centers in Iran with IPD permit, the rules and regulations, as well as tourism in Iran and Iranian hotels in different languages. Iran's health ministry has also announced that it will issue permits to those qualified tourism centers and institutes that are willing to work in the field of health tourism. These centers are ready to offer various types of services to medical tourists, and they can trustfully assign these centers the coordination job with the hospitals and let them reserve the hotel. To know more about these centers and institutes, the applicants can easily go to Iran's Health Ministry website. Also, many of these institutes have branches in many countries where the patients can ask them for more information in person. Dear listeners, this was the second episode of our program, Health Tourism. In the next episode, we will introduce one of reputable optometry hospitals in the Iranian capital, Tehran, called Farabi Hospital. Till next program, goodbye.
of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio. This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.